This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, good morning. I'm Philip C, and this is the Breakfast Grill. Degas once quoted, "In art, the hand can never execute anything higher than the heart can imagine." But can it translate into sustainable businesses? In conjunction with World Art Day, I have the privilege of being in conversation with Lim Weiling, founder of Weiling Gallery and Weiling Contemporary, and Irshad Saidin, CEO of Pentas.io, an NFT marketplace. There is no doubt pandemic has definitely upended our lives, right? And for sure, perhaps when one creates, curates, or even collects, and perhaps even collectively appreciate art, how has the pandemic changed the business of art?
Well, I mean, look, I think the pandemic's changed all our lives. I think everyone's, if you speak to anybody, I mean, no one's been left out of this. It's been really sort of, you know, very all-encompassing in some ways. And generally, the outlook on life has changed. Everyone's become a lot more introspective. And I think you prioritise, you start prioritising what's really important. One of the things that has really sort of surfaced is that people spend a lot more time at home. And when you spend more time at home, you're more cognizant of your surroundings, you know, how you're living, and naturally what you're seeing, right? What's around you. And so what we found, you know, during the pandemic, personally, I really enjoyed looking at my art more, the art that I have around me. I discovered more things about the works, you know, that I had in my collection, although they've been there for years, but I never spend that much time at home. You know, it's like you're sitting at home, you know, 24 hours literally during the lockdown, and you start looking at things differently. So in terms of the gallery and in terms of the way collectors or people who were looking at art or enjoying art looked at this was that people who were not collectors started being interested in art.
Yeah.
They started saying, hey, look, I really want to put something on my wall. I really want to start, you know, I want to start living with art. People who lived in condos started saying, I don't want to live in a condo anymore. I want to move into a house. I want to have more space around me. I think just the perspectives on the way you want to live have changed. And in a lot of ways, I think it's enhanced the quality of life.
I can imagine that, you know, that now art becomes most central to how you think about life, and it becomes critical that you imbue it and reflect it everywhere.
Yeah, and also interestingly, obviously artists have also lived through the pandemic. One of the things that I noticed significantly was that they had a lot more time to make work. So artists became a lot more productive because they're stuck at home. They're not sort of saying, oh, I'm thinking about it, I'm going to have a drink, and then, you know, like 3 weeks later, do nothing. Whereas when you're stuck at home, you're sitting there, and artists are much more productive and you're thinking about things.
So perhaps when I thought about this, I thought, okay, this must have been a crisis mode for someone like yourself with physical galleries and such. Did you think about that, you know, as you saw the lockdowns take place and say, oh my goodness, you saw the business really seeing a huge seismic change? Mm-hmm. Or did you kind of quickly say, oh, actually, this was an opportunity?
Absolutely. I have to say, Philip, I mean, of course, initially, I'm a bit like an ostrich burying its head in the sand. I said, nah, this lockdown can't affect me. We're not like this kind of business. But in truth, it was. It was like everything is shut down. I said, no, yeah, everything's closed. You're not going out anywhere. I said, okay, fantastic, great. So what happened was the team actually started being proactive in shifting. So what we were doing things like, okay, we started creating videos of the artists that we work with. Because I believe that when you look at the oeuvre of an artist, it is not about one artwork. It's not about one body of work. It's about their story. Mm. So how do you begin with the story? You've got to go to the beginning of the book. You've got to get to the beginning and understand how they've arrived at this point in their life. It could be 10 years, 15 years, 35 years. It's the journey. So what we started doing, the team, was we started collecting and arranging and creating videos on YouTube that tracked the journeys of our artists and through artworks.
And I guess for yourself, the journeys were relatively longish, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, and also it was very rich. Irsha, bring you into the picture. Your journey into the art world through Pentas.io, a very much new marketplace, touching on NFT per se. How did the pandemic frame your thinking about the work you did?
When And again, when it comes to creativities, right, we see there's another side of our story, because some artists are actually well-known artists. Whatever they do, whatever they draw, they already have their own fan base. They already have their own set of collectors. They become more productive, like what you said. But there's another side of story is there is a creativist which is maybe a hobbyist, maybe someone that have talent, maybe someone that, okay, before this, I have a job. Because of pandemic, I don't have a job. And actually, this is a true story. We do have cartoonists, which is what he do is actually he go to the tourism spot where he draw like for 15 ringgit, 30 ringgit per facial caricature and so on. Because of pandemic, totally flat. He don't have any income. Mm-hmm. And this is another, again, this is another side of story. And what is the best way for this group of talented creativists to do? Even before we launch our marketplace, some of them, when I heard the story that, okay, they do a food delivery, they really struggling. And even some of them, they don't have, how to say, their cars. The banks is calling them to for the cars payment and so on. Again, because of pandemic, hits a lot of people, especially the creative industry. There's another side of story, which is the small creators. Because of that, we believe that actually we see not only creative industry, we see there's a technological change. I love to touch on the technological change because I was so young when internet was introduced. I'm a small kid. I have no clue what is internet.
So was I.
Yeah,
me too.
So basically, I start to see there's a huge technological change. Yeah. If I want to put into perspective, internet itself, normally I would split into three category: web 1.0, web 2.0, web 3.0. And web 3.0 is the one that bring in not only you can post content, you can write content, but you can own digital content. It is governed by trustable ledger. That's where blockchain comes along. And because of that, it brings an opportunity to a new industry, which is most of the creators before this, for example, if you sell an art, mostly galleries take 30%, 40%, and even higher. And what if there's a marketplace that only take 2.5%? And there's a huge exposure. And again, there is also a perpetual royalty. Whatever digital art is being traded, they always get that perpetual royalty forever.
Yeah, I want to talk about the business model very soon, right? But you touch on a very interesting point about this whole definition of what we call now the creative economy, right? We've talked about that quite extensively. And you mentioned about these three pieces of technology. Essentially, technology is the platform. It's a platform that enables all sorts of things, right? But do you think as a result of enabling it, what has happened is that the definitions and the boundaries of art have blurred tremendously, haven't they? I mean, what we usually think of as understand as what is art has evolved, and you're seeing it meld and merge with fashion, sports and such, isn't it? That is the confusion now, right? That's the boundaries which have been totally blurred. Don't you think so, Rishad?
Because of the push of new digital economy, especially on arts, people can create beyond canvas. So which means it can be a 3D. Before this, how are you going to sell 3D? Do people really appreciate 3D generative arts? Do really people going to appreciate AR or VR type of arts? How do people presume it? How do people can, for example, before the existence of, let's say, this Web3 technology, people can right click save and there's no trail of ownership. And because of that, it allows, again, people to be more creative to utilize digital world to create new segment of digital art. So which is, this is not available before.
So enabling it, very valuable, right? What has happened is that the artist now has access to multiple platforms. You as a platform and curator also see the opportunities there. Even as a collector and someone who appreciates art, then sees the democratization of it and so much availability. But I really, really wonder whether it is a win-win-win situation for all three. Or is it a case of relative winners? There's some people within the art ecosystem that perhaps benefit more than others. And I wanted to just get your perspectives on that. Do you think it's an equitable win for everybody across the value chain?
Definitely. Because why I see mostly technological change the business structure. And it happens before. It's nothing new. It happens on the music industry before. We used to buy CD and cassettes. And we used to buy songs in iTunes. And now, we are shifting into audio stream. And even most of the radio station nowadays, they have a streaming service. So same goes with arts. So back then, of course, there's a physical gallery where you can come and view. But when it comes to enabling it as a digital platform, this is a huge opportunity because it brings up bigger audience, right? Because even for us, if let's say you launch it online, basically you instantly you have an international audience. So you have a bigger reach. You have a bigger pie.
What do you think?
Well, okay. So just carrying on from what you were saying, Isha. Yes, you might have a bigger pie. You might putting yourself out there, and yes, of course, out there on the World Wide Web, out there. You are competing with millions of people. I mean, so many people are artists and say, oh yes, you know, I can put my art on NFT and I can sell it. But how many actual NFT artists, digital artists, are actually realizing a sale? I mean, I've spoken to numerous artists who have put their works on the NFT platform, marketplaces, various marketplaces. They've not a single thing has sold. So you see, I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, and I've read about this extensively. I've attended a lot of webinars about this. It's curious. I'm curious about this world. I mean, I think we all are. I mean, look, it's out there. NFT is bombarding us all around. But the question is, at the end of the day, the narratives are still important. Yep. What the artist is saying, what's the messaging they're getting across, how it's marketed. Marketing is still important. You know, you say that, oh, you know, the gallery takes this amount, 30%, 40%. The digital platform charges, I don't know, what do you say, what, 2% or something?
2.5,
but
yeah.
What marketing is actually happening for each of those respective artworks or artists that you are putting on that marketplace? I mean, these are the questions that we're asking.
I mean, it's a valuable question about the role of curation, I feel, right?
Yeah.
Because you talk about the artist itself sometimes just doesn't know where to position or how to put perspective to the art, isn't it? And so the curator does that? Does the creator help do that?
Look, I think that what we're saying is I think a lot of the times artists are making their work. It's not necessarily about where the curator places it. I think it's really about, if an artist has a very strong narrative, they know where they're coming from. There's a philosophy behind their work. There's authenticity. You know, it's not just about, I'm going to create something. It's an image. There's nothing behind it. I'm going to stick it on a digital platform and sell it. I don't think that's going to work. I think fundamentally, the essence of an artwork or from someone creative, from someone who's, when you think about a creative person, they're creating something out of nothing. But it's not just about, oh, I think I can replicate that and it's going to look like that, you know, but it's more about, what's the thought process that's gone behind it? Tell us about why you're making that. It's not enough to just make something for the hell of it. Tell me what's behind
it. So the storytelling is vital. And, you know, Ursha, I want to bring you this to it, because there's so much talk also about these platforms.
Yep.
What happens is that the artist is also the collector. Where what you've seen so far is that the artist tends to hype up their own work by buying their own pieces of work to basically inflate prices.
Yep.
Aren't you afraid that that potentially, you know, distorts market and perhaps even destroys trust in the platform going forward?
That's the beauty about blockchain, because if you see, because based on the first thing that you raised, that do people really buy? Surprisingly, when we Pentas is go live on 31st of August last year, for the first 6 months traded volume, we have about 4.85 million traded volume in Pentas. So which means there is a buyer.
Of course.
And surprisingly, we achieved that within short period of time. And even once we go live, instantly within first week and second week, we have a huge spike of visitors and buyers. So back to your question, if artist buy himself, right, buy his own arts, blockchain is very transparent. You can see who owns that wallet. Even in Pentas, we have a page, a statistic that shows top 100 collectors in Pentas. And if you check their own wallet, you check one by one, you see they are a well-known collectors. They collect arts.
I find that very interesting, because it is true. If you go to his website, you will see a ranking of the top collectors and top creative artists. That's the frustration,
isn't
it?
But can I ask you this, though? Sorry. I'm just going to be the devil's advocate here, because I want to know as well.
It's interesting discussion.
You know, when you say that the wallet's linked to a collector, obviously the collector's name is not there, right? I mean, because you're in Web3, everything is under some sort of anonymity. It's a number. It's a number in the wallet. So it could be anyone's wallet, right?
That is the beauty about blockchain, because it's up
anonymity,
to the creators.
Right?
Yeah, that's the beauty about it, because it's up to the collectors, either they want to be known or
that's
don't want
what I'm saying. So going back
to
the
anonymous,
but going back to that question, then, so then okay, let's again devil's advocate. So I'm an artist.
Yep.
Okay, and I put 3 pieces out there for sale, just 3. All right. Then I go and ask some people out there. Can you go and create a wallet? Are you ABC out there? And you ABC, now you come and buy my artwork for 1 million, 600,000, whatever, like in Ether, in the equivalent in Ether. And it's linked to their wallet, like ABC's wallet. How do you tell if that's ABC is a real collector or just a friend of the artist to create the hype?
Even the friend of artists means what? If they're doing that, they are supporting the artist.
No, what I'm saying is, you know what I'm saying, right?
Yeah, because if you see,
I mean,
this actually, it's not happened on the digital world. It's also happened in the...
I'm saying is, on the crypto market, because it's it's on one hand it's open, the wallets are open, you can see who's buying it, it's transparent, but actually it's opaque.
I guess that's the big question, right?
Yeah.
I think you try to create a ledger, you try to create some rankings, but there is an underlying challenge about how do we make sure that actually, is it really a genuine list that's transparent truly? And I think that's the biggest challenge here, isn't it?
Of course, that's part of challenge. But again, people who are buying arts or people who are buying collectors, of course, there might be some percentage who are really, okay, this part of the maybe certain people marketing strategy to push, initial snowball. But again, based on statistic, based on data that we have, even top 100, the one that spend almost 80% of whatever traded volume in Pentas, they are actually genuine collectors, which is they also collect physical art. They also collect some of the arts from even different marketplace. And they are, again, they are also the one that part of their narrative is not only, okay, I just want to buy art, but I also want to support the artist, because the artist itself is maybe someone that,
Can I interject? Sorry, I have to ask a question, because you're here.
It's very interesting discussion,
So my question is, would you say, except for my very little research, would you say it is more, I think it's, what's the word for it? Perhaps more transparent or realistic. If an NFT artist or an artist who's listed their work on NFT and say they had done, say, an edition of 100 or 200 editions, and then they managed to sell those 200 and then they realized an amount, a couple of million or whatever, would you say that's more authentic? I mean, as in, like, that's more realistic, because more than, like, 200 people have bought, not just three. To justify, like, you know, like, they've raised how many million?
What is the main purpose of that, to justify that, okay, I need to make sure? Because for us, artists, again, there are two. But for me, I see there are two types of artists. One artist is actually, okay, I love to create. I love to showcase it. I will share to people. I don't have any interest to share. But some artists is commercial artists, means they need to sell. They need to earn income from there. People who buy means people are really interested to acquire it.
Yeah, of course.
So it doesn't matter if, let's say, I'm a single artist, I buy everyone. Or, for example, if, let's say, I'm a single collector, I buy all of your arts, even though I have multiple wallets. For me, I don't see that as a big issue, because why? That collector is a fan of that artist. Right? I don't want, maybe certain collectors, I don't want to show that, okay, I'm the one that only buying all of your art. I really love your art. I really love to collect your art. So I can be anonymous, like, okay, I create another three separate wallet. I'm buying one because I need to support you. I love you. I'm betting on that artist's career.
Willing?
I think going back, sorry, if I didn't phrase my question correctly. I think the question I'm asking you is, if an artist has produced, say, an open edition, right? That means they don't, it's an unlimited edition of works, and they sell each of those for, I don't know, let's say 2,000 to 3,000 ringgit, and then collectively that amounts to, say they sell, okay, 3,000, say they sell 100, that is, 300,000, right?
Yeah.
Something like that. So then that becomes a bit more authentic, because then you say, okay, you know, 100 people out there, 100 wallets have come in and purchased this. They each have one. And there's some sort of, I feel that that's kind of grounded a bit better in that sense. I mean, like, okay, Khatoum, you know, there's this artist called Khatoum, right? And he did this incredible launch and he made the news because he had done this NFT work. But in truth, I think his I was very impressed with that, because I thought he had done quite a lot of editions and they'd gone all around the world, I think.
Yep.
They were not just centered in Asia or Malaysia or whatever collectors that he knows. They've gone out there. However, I do question when it's just two or three pieces or whatever it is.
So I think you're talking about, what is that process of establishing credibility?
Yes.
Yep. The process of essentially making sure that this is legitimate, that it is a bona fide artist rather than someone who's
just hyping.
Surprisingly, even us Pentas, we take one very interesting initiative. If you go to any Pentas profile or any Pentas collection, you'll see there's an analytic shows that how many items sold, how many owners they have. So this actually is part of indicators that indicates, okay, this artist released a 1,000 type of arts and it's owned by 800 people, 800 wallets. So it indicates that the diversity. So we do have this.
Okay, great. On The Breakfast Grill, we are in panel discussion with Lim Wei Ling, founder of Wei Ling Gallery and Wei Ling Contemporary, as well as Irshad Saidin, CEO of Pentas.io, on the business of art in conjunction with World Art Day. After these messages, how the business model has evolved. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back on The Breakfast Grill. We're in conversation with Lim Wei Ling, founder of Wei Ling Gallery and Wei Ling Contemporary, and Irshad Saidin, CEO of Pintas.io. Let's just talk about business models here, right? Has things changed for you, Wei Ling, you know, with respect to the past 5 to 10 years, in terms of the business model of how you've run your art galleries?
If I look back 5 to 10 years, okay, yes and no. Yes, in the sense that I think basically the way things are happening today are quite different. Different in the way that we run our exhibitions. Previously, I was focused on sort of doing a show every month, and then it was a selling show, a commercial show, and then in and out, and that was it. But over the last 5 years or so, the focus for us has also shifted. I mean, look, I believe, you know, you can't be doing the same old thing all the time.
It's evolving, right?
Yeah, it has to evolve. Just like artists' lives need to evolve, we need to evolve, right, as a gallery. So the last 5 years, what's happened is I've done some commercial shows, and I've also done some non-commercial shows, because I found that the non-commercial shows actually, perhaps, you know, we can do projects, or we can do installations, we can commission artists to expand on a particular topic that's more immersive. Mm. So when audiences come, they can feel immersed in it and maybe get a better understanding.
Yep.
So it's like a balance. And I feel that maybe commercially, that from a business perspective, people are going, oh, maybe that's not such a great idea. But I think from a holistic point of view, and for the gallery, and for our standing, and our curatorial program, and the way our artists are responding, I think it gives a lot more depth to what it is that we're doing. In terms of the pandemic, pre-pandemic, we were like having huge exhibitions, and we'd have like, oh my God, if 200 people don't come, oh my God, it's a failure. I know 200 people didn't come for your opening, right? But then what happened was in the midst of the pandemic, we opened up for like, I don't know, a month or two, and you could only have limited numbers of people at any one time. Then we started doing like smaller gatherings, and there was no pressure, right? There's like only 15 people came, okay?
Yes. It's quality, not quantity, then?
Absolutely. It was a much more intimate setting, and I think visitors who came left inspired, left with a lot more. They left feeling that, they'd come in and learn something or garnered something from the experience.
So basically what I gauge from you is that you've actually narrowed down the scope a bit to build depth, and you then got people more interested and deeper in love with the art they did.
Correct.
That's very counter to what you do, right?
Yep.
Which is, instead of going into depth, you democratize it, you make it so broad and make it available at Pintas. And is that a sign that perhaps there is art available for both sides of, you know, of society, right? One where they are interested in the deeper narratives and stories going forward, and there are those who are thinking about it more transactionally, a bit more on a commercial side.
In terms of NFT, again, of course, we in Pintas, we do have a fine artist like Radwan Man. Mm. He's the only Malaysian ranked on Sotheby's, and Sotheby's is the largest auction house in the world related to arts. And we do, what part of our strategy is only not only for people to collect digital collectibles, but at the same time to create us as part of utility. And do you know that there are some project, especially they're instead of you just buy an art and you just use it for display, but people can use that as utility. Example, if I buy this, I get a discount at certain shops, and this is actually happening. And what we are building is not only a visual graphic only, but we are building the entire ecosystem by utilizing arts. So this is part of our example. And this is part of the things that we are building, and we are pushing toward the future potential of digital arts.
But it sounds very businessy, right? It sounds very like, I'm doing this because I want to make money. You know, I want to basically... And that seems to be at the forefront first, before we talk about how we get there. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether that's upended how we think about art, which is usually I create something out of love, out of, you know, the desire to create something beautiful, or that inspires or provokes to a certain extent. And then in the process, let me try and make a living out of that, you know. Have we appended that whole equation?
No, I don't. Look, I think, at the end of the day, look, I am not discounting that world. I mean, you were saying that, yes, we've moved away from... it always has been. The gallery has been more sort of focused on a particular segment. It's true. People who come are... It's a small segment of society.
But you get scorned, right, for being elitist?
No, not at all. Not at all. Because, Philip, what happens is the gallery, our gallery, I think a lot of galleries in KL, we are open, free. It's free of admission. Anyone anyone can just come whenever they want to. And they're open to ask questions. People are very willing to talk to you. But it is a physical space, okay? So the digital realm, the digital world, I think it's important, but it's in bridging that. It's in bridging it and in, I believe, upholding what is intrinsically important in art, in an artist, in what an artist creates.
But that's the biggest challenge with digital, isn't it? That I sense that a lot of people want to put clear parameters. They want to hold people to clear accountability and all that. But it's hard. It's like you can't cage
but
the tiger.
But okay, so you know what happens. You know what's happening now, right? And I'm sure you know this. People are plagiarizing other people's NFTs. So I am a digital artist or I'm an artist. I put an artwork, I list it on a marketplace and suddenly someone takes that image and they go and list it as their own image on another marketplace. And, you know, there's a lot of this happening. There's a big problem now.
How do you manage that? You know, how do you basically manage that? Different marketplaces.
In terms of plagiarism, it's not only happen on Pentas or any other NFT marketplace or NFT spaces. It happened in movie industry. It happened in music industry. So there's the things that always happen. So what we are doing is to counter this, even if you go to our platform, if you go to Pentas, we have a feature called verified creators. Verified creators means if you reach certain benchmark, you need to do a bit of KYC, who you are, then you are become verified creators. And we also have a feature where if you want to buy any NFT or if you see any people that potentially plagiarize NFT, there's a report flag and people can send a report and we can take it down. So this is
Of course. But what if someone's already bought it? Then what happens? What if I've already bought the plagiarized NFT? I didn't know. It's too late. What happens then?
Theoretically, of course, that is beyond our control. Mm. But again, as I said, this has happened before. What happened if people buy a Cetak Rompak CD or
accidentally? I mean,
it's the same narrative.
Yeah, but
then
but I guess there will have to come a point of time where it hits a certain scale. Mm. Then people say, okay, we have to take it seriously. Then how do you take the preemptive measures, isn't it? That's the biggest question.
This is also a reason why if you go to Pentas, if you go to Marketplace, the first thing that you see is our verified. Unless you want to go deeper, which is you want to go for all of the creators, actually there's a switch to toggle between verified and non-verified.
But these are only the ones who are on your site, lah.
Yes, so I think they are trying to curate it. But now that's the bigger question, right? Yeah. Let me just talk about market then. Malaysia, are we creating an artificial boundary called Malaysia when we talk about platforms or even art per se? Because some would say, for example, like Pentas, why do we make it so Southeast Asian centric? Why do we need to have that geographic boundary? Mm. And even like for yourself, Weiling, when you think about your gallery, do we need to be able to be confined by our physical boundaries as well, right? That I think for me is the question as we move forward with digitalization. How do we break those boundaries and the constructs of physicality here?
Okay, especially if you're building a product or brands, right? You need to have a very strong root. Even one of our strategy is Pentas, we need to be number one. We need to be
number one for where?
Number one NFT marketplace in the world.
World?
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, that is our aim.
Okay.
And how do we do it? You need to, of course, for us, what we see is you need to build a strong root. And especially in this region, we have a lot of talented artists. We have a lot of culture and heritage stuff. And we love to export that as an identity first to introduce us to the world. And if people want to know, okay, Pentas is born in Southeast Asia, and there'll be more. And surprisingly, now there is exhibition coming in from Indonesia, Jakarta NFT exhibition with Pentas. There is there's one also exhibition in Bali. So it start to expand. And surprisingly, again, we have buyers and also creators from Europe. So especially for us, when it comes to business strategy, how do we position ourselves? You need to have a USP, unique selling point, who you are and what is your identity.
All right. And so for you yourself, Willing, for your galleries, right, how do you think about your USP now or your selling position, proposition?
Well, look, the premise on which we started the gallery 20 years ago, and it hasn't changed, has always been our starting point, which is Malaysia. Because I think at that time when we started, Malaysian artists needed a platform. I think they still do. And we've been in the business of nurturing and giving them that promoting and taking them internationally, that getting them known beyond the shores of Malaysia. And then what has happened over the years is that I do work with international artists as well. So we don't limit ourselves to any particular region. I mean, we work with artists from Pakistan, from India, from Europe, from the States, from Africa. I mean, we are not limited by that.
You don't limit by that.
But we are looking for is that we are looking for artists, international artists, who have already made a name for themselves in their country of origin. So I'm not bringing in artists whom I'm nurturing from overseas.
I get it. I get what you're saying, right? You want people people who are basically homegrown, who have earned their stripes
already
back home,
in their home,
in their homegrown, right?
Yeah, and they come to Malaysia and they show with us.
But I do see that frustration that many Malaysian artists actually decide that I can't grow in Malaysia. I have to grow outside Malaysia and then make my name after outside and then come back to Malaysia. Is that happening or not really?
Not so. I wouldn't say that. I mean, I would say that I think there's only one Malaysian artist, really big Malaysian artist, H.H. Lim, who lives in Rome, who's been in Rome for like 40 years. He made his name in Europe and internationally. And his first solo was with us like 7 years ago. So, okay, so he's one. But I think generally, look, you know, say what you want. Artists are pretty free to say what they want to say here and do the things that they want to do. I mean, it's, you know, there's... And I think, yes, although there are things like this, of course, there's sensitivities within which one works, confines of being a Malaysian artist. I think that makes the work that much more interesting because you have to navigate around that, right? So you're much more sort of, yeah.
Do you feel these... I presume if she's not feeling... If Wailing's not feeling it on the physical space and with her galleries, you have no boundary set, right, over these limits?
Again, it goes back to our strategy because if instantly you want to target immediately audience, for example, in US or Europe, you don't have an initial crowd. So that's why you need to have a localization to be your initial crowd. And from that initial crowd, you need to use it as a catapult. So that is a strategy that we're implementing. And we are not limiting geographically or what. So historically, or any tech startup, even Facebook itself, it starts from university. So it starts with a group of small people. From that, it scale up and scale up. And that is also a strategy what we are doing. So which means the first step we need to do is actually we need to uplift local artists. Then what is the next step? We need to uplift regional artists. What is the next step? Then we need to uplift everyone. So that is, again, it goes back to the strategy what we are doing. And at the end of the journey, actually, we really have a target of a global.
On this special extended breakfast grill, we are in panel discussion with Lim Wailing, founder of Wailing Gallery and Wailing Contemporary, and Irshad Saidin, CEO of Pentas IO, in conjunction with World Art Day. After the 8:30 news bulletin, we ask the broader goals of art, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to this special extended breakfast grill with Lim Wailing, founder of Wailing Gallery and Wailing Contemporary, and Irshad Saidin, CEO of Pentas IO, on how the business of art has evolved throughout the pandemic. Irshad, how hard was it for you to set up your NFT marketplace?
For NFT marketplace, it's not easy, to be frank.
Why?
Again, I love to give this analogy, it's like chicken and egg game. If you bring in the artist, who's going to be the buyer? If you're going to bring in the buyer, who's going to be the artist? So there are so many, because I started the development back in May last year. And we go...
But you've grown so fast. What was the trigger point there?
I believe because of pandemic, there's a lot of people need to push themselves, need to have an extra income. And as I mentioned earlier, there are not many people has a lot of privilege. Again, for well-known artists, I can just take 1 year to produce a very, how to say, interesting masterpiece. But not many people has this privilege. And it's not easy and it's a bit challenging because for us, actually, we are bootstrapping. Means we use our own fund. We try to run the company. We did not involve with any like either government agencies or grant or anything. We are on our own. Based on that, and people know to build a marketplace, it required a lot of resource, especially to push up, to market it, to promote it.
So your timing was right. You got the right timing, but you think that window has narrowed substantially. It's very hard now.
You just need that initial snowball. So once you have that snowball rolling, you keep on building.
And then can I just transition over to you, Wailing?
Sure.
Do you empathize with those aspiring gallery owners now as they try to open up? Or is it incredibly easy or difficult?
Oh, I mean, look, I think, look, there's definitely a lot more people in the industry now. So for sure, I mean, the market, if the market is able to sort of grow, that means the number of buyers, collectors is going to grow in tandem with the number of galleries that are opening.
I must say, because I live in PJ, I see a whole mushrooming of galleries
everywhere,
right?
Absolutely.
Is there an oversupply there then?
Well, I'm not sure about that. I mean, there could be, because at the end of the day, not all galleries are created equally, right? Not all artists are created equally. So who are they showing, right? At the end of the day, I mean, I gave a talk yesterday about art appreciation and how do you pick an artist and stuff like that. And I mean, it's just essentially giving people tools, like things, the questions to ask. Like, you like an artwork.
Yeah.
How do you start? Like, you know, how do you get into it? So things like look at the CV of the artist. Okay, ask to see what the artist, if they've been working for 5, 10 years, ask to see the work they did 10 years ago. Is the work that they did 10 years ago remarkably similar to what you're seeing today. That, you know, because if it is, maybe that artist is a business person. So,
well,
not a creative person.
Which means,
not an artist.
Especially for gallery, so it means it's not an easy entry for, let's say, hobbies to start an art journey and immediately go to gallery. So it means it's totally not possible, right?
It is not,
It is not easy. And I think what you're trying to do, Wei Ling, is you're trying to create a bit more education for us to discern so that we pick and choose the right artist, right?
Correct.
And the right works of art that resonate and also reflect the value. And I think that's the biggest question, right? Value in how do you value art? Because we've talked in NFTs, crazy valuations, right? And sometimes the basis of the valuation is hard, especially in a market where education and awareness of the history and the story of that artist is suspect.
Okay, valuation is subjective. Again, it can be people value arts because they really love it, they really enjoy whatever a visual representation that the artist produce. It can also people value it because of the name of the artist, because the artist has a strong reputation. He has interesting track record, especially on whatever release that he released before. And also it can be part of historical value. For example, maybe those are whatever arts has been viral before, has been, we've seen that everywhere in the world. So that is also can be, because of that famous graphic, which is you've seen it everywhere, it gone viral, and it only have one copy in the world, of course people will fight to own it, and it is also part of bragging right.
So there's a question, there's a distinction between authenticity, which is the originality of it, versus the virality of it, isn't it? And I think that's where we struggle to pass out the value between what is authentic and original versus the virality of that. Correct me if I'm wrong. And I think when people get caught up with the virality of the valuation of the art, then that's when we enter a very slippery slope. Isn't it?
There is an art has been sold in Pentas, which is it has not gone viral, but of course that art was done I think a few years back before NFTs. And one of the artists is actually Suena Jo. He draw a painting called Rusuk Emas, and I think it was sold for roughly about 52,000 ringgit digitally. And also of course the collectors who bought it can obtain the physical arts. So again, the collectors who bought it, he also appreciate the arts that the artist create, because that piece has not gone viral. Of course, people know who's the creators, but I believe comparing to a prominent, well-known global artist, I think it's maybe there's a far hit.
And you know, when you think about art now, as we enter very hypersensitive times, you know, we think so many issues being raised globally. Are there limits to the commercialization of art here? Do you think that as artists try to provoke, try to incite and even get people to think or even get agitated by it, do you think you see this arc where the valuations kind of plateau?
No, I think that at the end of the day, I mean, if you're looking at what authenticity stands for today, nothing's authentic anymore. Everything's been done for. You know, there's nothing really original out there. The only thing that can be original or is original in the world that we're living in today is thought, is the concept, is the ideology, what's behind it, what was that person saying. So I think the work, contemporary art today, a lot, you know, you'd be surprised, a lot of contemporary art today is not even made by the creator. It is purely a thought concept, concept, a thought process, an idea that they then materialize through a factory, or they ask someone else to make it. So in some ways, I mean, there's of course that debate, but the craft is gone, the hand of the artist is gone, but it's all in the thought process, you know. So when we ask about whether the commercialization of that is plateauing, I wouldn't say so, because I think today people invest in that IP, in the intellectual thought processes.
And so do you think digital platforms best elucidate that thought, the originality of thought?
I don't like when people say when you want to express something, it must be on canvas. People can do that on digital form. It can be, again, 3D sculpture. That is also a process of expressing a thought. And because of people are doing that, it also must be appreciated equally, which means there must be a solution, there must be a technology behind it to lock the value, to have a trustable process where people can really acquire it.
Wei Ling, Urshad, thank you for taking your time with us.
Thank you
for giving us a peek into the world of art on The Breakfast Grill. I'm with Lim Wei Ling, founder of Wei Ling Gallery and Wei Ling Contemporary, and Urshad Saidin, CEO of Pentas.io. I'm Philip C, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.